In late July, the United Kingdom saw more than one kind of celebration of national pride. As citizens of the UK were just gearing up for the Olympics, their government announced a bold plan to accelerate innovation and access to information. Any research funded by the United Kingdom, they said, would have to be made freely and publicly accessible to all. A quote from the UK's Science Minister, David Willetts: "Removing paywalls that surround taxpayer-funded research will have real economic and social benefits. It will allow academics and businesses to develop and commercialize their research more easily and herald a new era of academic discovery." The UK's plan is part of the Open Access movement. By adopting open access, the UK joins nations like Denmark, Australia, and the United States in discussion of the policy, as well as universities like Harvard and Duke that are moving to make large amounts of research available publicly, eliminating the barriers put in place by costly journal subscriptions. But open access is still a touchy subject in some corners, not least because it's tough to negotiate between the interests of researchers, universities, and publishers. Today's guest, Peter Suber, is the director of the Harvard Open Access Project and the author of a new guide for those attempting to make sense of open access, called simply Open Access. Peter talks with David Weinberger about the promise of open access and how to apply it.
Stuart Schiebert, who's a colleague of ours, blogged recently that it's beginning to look like open access is inevitable. What is it about open access that could possibly make it inevitable?
It's taking advantage of the internet, and any industry that hasn't been taking advantage of the internet inevitably will take advantage of the internet. That's why publishing will eventually take advantage of the internet.
Then why shouldn't it be inevitable? What are the obstacles?
Why haven't we gotten there?
Yeah, it's taking so long.
That's right. Well, the answer is that publishers like to sell their works, and open access isn't selling them. It's giving them away. So what publishers are doing is finding business models that are compatible with open access, which can be done, or they are simply allowing authors to make their works open access alongside the editions that the publishers are selling, and that also works.
It sounds like if I were a publisher, I would not be entirely happy about either of those.
That's actually right, and publishers have not been happy, and that's why it's important for Stuart to collect these comments by publishers, showing that not only have they accommodated themselves to the fact that open access is here to stay, but that it's inevitable.
So other than the fact that there is an internet, what are the social forces, for example, that are pushing open access forward?
Mainly the needs of research. Researchers need access to the research already done by other researchers. And without open access, they have to pay for access, or they have to belong to institutions that pay. And even wealthy institutions can't afford to buy the access to the full range of existing literature. This is true everywhere, but it is dramatic when Harvard University, the wealthiest library in the world, says it doesn't have the money to buy access to the full range of research. Every other library is worse off. And at libraries in sub-Saharan Africa, there are libraries with subscriptions to zero journals.
So if I were a publisher, I would be reducing my subscription costs. Is that what's happening?
Scholarly publishing is not an ordinary market where you reduce your prices to gain a competitive advantage. Without open access, let's just leave that out of the picture for a moment, scholarly journals don't really compete for price. Every journal is a mini monopoly. It's the only journal publishing those particular articles. Journals don't duplicate each other. So if you do create some efficiencies and lower your prices, you're not really creating an advantage for yourself. People who need access to other people's articles have to subscribe to those journals or come up with the money for pay-per-view access. And the fact that you're cheaper doesn't mean that they dispense with those other articles and go to your journal instead. This is why expensive and inexpensive journals can coexist in the same field, and it's why free or open access journals can coexist with expensive journals in the same field. The inexpensive and free ones don't drive the prices down on the other journals, and they don't drive them out of business. So publishers have very little incentive to create these efficiencies and lower their prices, even though some of them are, in fact, doing it because their income is being squeezed.
There are certainly still, let's say, social and career reasons why at least some researchers like to publish in closed access journals. Is that changing?
Right. It is changing. The advantage for researchers is not that the closed access journals are closed. It's that some closed access journals are prestigious. So the advantage comes from the prestige, not from the lack of openness. And when an open journal is just as prestigious as a closed journal, then all the advantages lie on the open side. But to gain this kind of prestige, a journal needs to have been in existence for a long time. It needs to be venerable. It needs to have been around long enough to have a reputation. And open access journals tend to be new for obvious reasons. So most of the venerable high-prestige journals are not open. Some of them have converted to open. Some of them are now allowing open without providing open. Some of them are permitting authors to provide open. But by default, most of them are not open. And the incentives for researchers, especially university faculty members, is to publish in high-prestige journals regardless of the terms of access.
One of the qualities that gives a journal prestige, though, is not simply that it's old and that it's venerable. It's that it excludes most of what is submitted, that there's some type of editorial process, peer review process, and very few items get in.
Right, but open access journals can have rigorous peer review at the very same levels. Having rigorous peer review and having a high rejection rate is orthogonal to openness in this sense, because it doesn't mean the journal must be sold as opposed to given away. It just means that the editorial process has to be selective. The older journals can be more selective. Journals that have more prestige, have a better reputation, can be more selective because they have more submissions. And the more submissions you have, the more you can afford to reject a larger number. But the same thing can happen on the open access side. So as open access journals become prestigious, as they become selective, they become prestigious. As they become prestigious, they become selective. Then they have the same advantages that the venerable, high prestige, high quality closed journals have had. But there's never been an advantage in being closed. There's only been an advantage in being high quality, high impact, high prestige. There's a related problem for open access journals, which is that in order to acquire prestige, they must attract high quality submissions. But in order to attract high quality submissions, they need prestige. So brand new journals that have few submissions and no prestige yet, because they're brand new, have a hard time acquiring prestige and quality. So this is another reason why the incumbent journals have a built-in advantage. Again, not because they're closed, just because they've been around long enough to have both submissions and prestige.
One of the things that keeps the traditional journals high prestige is the impact factor,
yes,
way of measuring the effect of the journal. Are we finding new ways to measure impact?
We are, and it's about time. The impact factor was always a crude simplification of research impact. It was a good idea to look for research impact, but it was a bad idea to look for it in this simplistic measurement. The impact factor measured the citation impact of a journal. It did not measure the impact of the article. It did not measure the impact of the author. It was the average citations acquired by the whole journal, and a given author might have been the one who brought down the average. The given article might be atrocious, or it might be cited widely because of its mistakes. Moreover, the impact factor can be gamed, and journals can ask authors, often do ask authors, to cite more articles from the same journal. Authors can cite themselves. Authors and their friends can agree to cite each other. It says nothing about quality, but it has been used as a quality measurement or as a surrogate for a quality measurement, since we don't have a quality measurement. Fortunately, we have more accurate, more nuanced, more subtle, more comprehensive measures for impact now. In the digital age, there are more things you can measure in order to get the full picture of impact. For example, you can measure downloads in addition to citations. You can measure what some people call the batting average. If an article has a splash page that simply just gives the title and the abstract and some metadata, and you have to click through to read the full text, you can see how many people reach the splash page and then click through, and how many people reach the splash page and don't. You can measure how many times the article comes up in a search. And again, it's batting average when it comes up in a search. You can measure the buzz in the blogosphere. That's harder to do, but people are working on it. All together, these are called alternative metrics or alt metrics, and they're still under development, but they're very exciting, in part because they're more valid, they're more accurate. They give us a more true picture of research impact. I wish promotion and tenure committees would stop using impact factor today, even in the absence of a better alternative metric. But in fact, we do have better alternative metrics already.
I mean, you'd think that a tenure committee would have a sense of what the prestigious journals are, even outside of a quantification like the
They do,
factor.
But in a way that's the problem, because what they think of as prestige is not a measurement like impact factor. It's reputation, and a journal might be floating on its previous quality, and the given article in front of the committee might be better or worse than the reputation the journal carries in general. Promotion and tenure committees ought to judge the quality of the candidate, not the quality of the journals in which the candidates publish. When they use the quality of the journals, basically they're outsourcing the decision about the quality of their own faculty to journals and publishers. That's a mistake.
Do you see a consolidation around particular alternative metrics? When there's a welter of them, it would be very difficult for institutions to decide to kick out a venerable metric and replace it with something else. Is there some type of consolidation?
As far as I can tell, the answer is no. It's not as if there's one alt metric which is better than impact factor. What's better than impact factor is using many separate measurements in some kind of weighted average. The trick is to pull together the right components and then to weight them properly. And I think we're still experimenting with the best ways to do that. But the result will be a composite measurement that takes many things into account.
Or conceivably be replaced by not outsourcing to metrics at all.
Yes, or at least not outsourcing to publishers and journals alone. You'll be outsourcing to the whole research community insofar as you can measure their response to an article.
To what extent are you concerned about metrics that move from the sober consideration of an appointed peer review group for an established journal, that being replaced by metrics that include social media where you're hearing from voices that have not been vetted or qualified?
First of all, alt metrics generally focus on the impact of articles, not journals. That's one way in which they're superior, because when you're evaluating a candidate for hiring, promotion, or tenure, you want to know about their work, not the work of the journals in which they publish in general or on average. Second, you want an accurate, nuanced, comprehensive picture of the impact their work has had on the research community. The fact that it was published in a selective journal is one thing to take into account, and it's a valid indicator, but it's only one of many. And alt metrics bring in the rest of the many. That's what's interesting. Now, if the social media component of that deserves light weight, then it should get light weight in the weighted average. But you want to take it into account. Nowadays, a lot of the discussion about peer-reviewed research articles takes place in the blogosphere alongside DREC. And we have to learn how to measure that and sort them out. But it doesn't help measure impact to ignore that discussion.
In fact, in some fields, articles that need timely discussion, like faster-than-light neutrino data, gets posted in open-access repositories. No prior peer review involved at all.
That's right. And scholars use the tools they have. So when a new finding is published or when a new argument is published, scholars will just jump on their blogs or Twitter and start talking about it. Usually they jump on media that allow them to be more long-winded than Twitter does. But that's where they jump. And we need tools that follow the conversation where it goes and measure that. That's hard to do, by the way. That's the hardest part of altmetrics, is measuring the buzz. But even without that, if you get a lightweight or just disregard it entirely, there's still lots of other measurable components of research impact that are now being measured.
Right, and so obviously, as you say, this is not simply a change in measurement techniques. It's also a change in measurement techniques that's following what is possibly a change in the nature of scholarly discourse.
It's, I think, taking more seriously the responsibility to evaluate candidates for their quality. We don't have a quality measurement. With some effort, we can have an impact measurement. And so we're trying to find impact measurements that are better and better to take the place of a quality measurement. If we had a quality measurement, we would use it. The best quality measurement we have is to read the work of the individual candidate and evaluate it. But that only works when we're in the same field as the candidate. It works in hiring committees. It doesn't work on tenure committees, who tend not to be in the candidate's field. So we want the best picture we can get of the candidate's real impact. And if the impact extends beyond the echoes and reflections of the article in other peer-reviewed journal articles and is found in search engines and social media, that's where we have to go to look for it. But this is the impact of peer-reviewed articles, not the impact of blog comments that are not themselves peer-reviewed. So we're not talking about doing away with peer review or subordinating it. We're talking about measuring the effect of it.
Yes, but.
Yes.
So, no, and that's, you're making a very important point that often gets lost in the open access discussion, especially among people who are new to it. Mm-hmm. They assume that open access is the opposite of peer review.
Yes, actually, thanks for the opening. I'll elaborate on that just for a second. Yeah. One of the most common and harmful misunderstandings about open access is that the very purpose is to bypass peer review, and it's to make all scholarly literature like Wikipedia or like blogs. Not at all true. We want open access to the peer-reviewed literature. We also want open access to other kinds of literature that are not peer-reviewed, including preprints, which are destined to become peer-reviewed articles but aren't yet because they're just drafts, blog comments, Wikipedia articles, the whole picture. But we want open access to peer-reviewed literature, too. And that's the focus of most open access policies and most open access advocacy.
Well, this might be a good time to distinguish between colors of, of open access.
Yes. There are two. And unfortunately, we use colors which are not self-explanatory. Gold open access is open access through journals, and this means peer-reviewed journals. It's just like publishing in a traditional journal, except the result is open access instead of not.
Anybody can read it for free.
Anybody can read it for free, and if the journal does things the right way, they can also reuse it under an open license. Translate it, for example. Use it for text mining. Redistribute it on CD-ROM to parts of the world that don't have good online access. Green open access is open access through a repository, and it's a good place to distribute preprints that have not yet been published by journals, but also peer-reviewed articles that have been published in journals where the journals themselves don't provide open access. Now, it's not piracy. It's not done in violation of copyright. You do it with the permission of the copyright holder. Therefore, you either need the permission of the journal, if it's the copyright holder, or the author retains the right to deposit in a repository when they publish. So the author retains the relevant right and is the one to authorize green open access.
Well, that leaves out an obvious possibility, which is people who are writing, not preprint, but writing the full developed article. It's not being published anywhere else, and they use the repository as a publishing vehicle.
That's right. And that's pretty rare for an author to bypass peer review and put it in a repository without peer review. It can be done. Some authors have done it. Gregory Perlman, who proved the Poincaré conjecture, and by the way, turned down the Fields Medal and the $1 million Clay Institute Prize, did just that. He was eccentric in many ways, and one of those ways was that he distrusted peer-reviewed journals, and he didn't care at all for the impact that would come from publishing in a high-prestige journal. He simply wanted to get his result out. So he deposited his manuscript in an open-access repository with no peer review. Mathematicians were waiting for his article. They read it carefully. They decided he was right, his proof was valid, and that's it. He got all the renown that a good mathematician is entitled to, minus the renown that comes from publishing in a journal, which he didn't care about. He's very rare. He was not a faculty member. He didn't care about promotion or tenure. And there's almost no other example of anybody doing that.
He turned down the Field Prize.
That's right. He even won $1 million prize, and he turned that down. And again, very few people will do that. So he was eccentric. There are repositories that take more preprints than postprints, that is, more unrefereed manuscripts than peer-reviewed articles. They're places where scholars go to find preprints, to find articles that are still being drafted, where they might have a chance to read something brand new or to influence the final argument in a paper. But even those preprints are destined for submission to a peer-reviewed journal, and they eventually show up there. In some fields, the important debates and scholarly conversations are based on preprints, for example, in particle physics. And the peer-reviewed journal literature is mostly an archive for articles that are too old to be of interest anymore. Peer review creates delay, and in some fields, delay is harmful, or at least scholars are looking for ways to bypass delay. Not to bypass peer review, because they don't they want to eliminate quality filters. They want to bypass delay. So they share preprints, and they're in a position to judge the quality of the preprints they find, and they take off from there. They find people with whom to collaborate, or they publish their own dissent, whatever they do in scholarly discourse. But they don't wait for the peer-reviewed article to be published. And after all this is done, the author publishes the peer-reviewed version, but nobody's reading that anymore because they've already read the preprint, and it already played its role in the discussion. That's only in some fields. That tends to be the case in physics, for other reasons in computer science. But in most other fields, preprints play a small role. For example, in medicine, they play almost no role.
And why is that, since you think there is special urgency there?
There is special urgency in medicine, and there's harm in delay in medicine even more than there is in physics. But in medicine, journals for a long time have adopted the rule not to publish articles that have previously circulated. This is called the Engelfinger rule. And the rationale for the rule is medical results that have not been peer-reviewed might be harmful to the public. So we don't want medical research to be disseminated unless it has the imprimatur of some other scholars. That was probably a sincere rationale, but we can't overlook the rationale that the journals wanted exclusivity, and they wanted the scoop, and they wanted the profit that comes from getting the scoop. But the Engelfinger rule makes some sense in medicine. It makes no sense in any other field. It used to be common. It began to spread, in fact, beyond medicine because of its, call it, economic rationale. But now I think it's generally declining. But in medicine, it's still very common. So medical researchers are reluctant to deposit preprints or to circulate preprints. They're even reluctant to hold press conferences or issue press releases on major findings before they publish, because they might jeopardize their chance at publishing.
So on the one hand, we have the world of open access with peer-reviewed open access journals and as gold and a green of repositories that are preprint before peer review or after peer review and acceptance, and only rarely, as in the case of crazed Russian mathematicians, only rarely circumventing peer review. Take that entire open access realm, and then you have the rest of the wild, crazy web where people have an idea and they post it, and it could be a scholar, it could be a very good idea,
yes,
serious work that's being done, maybe being done in conversation with others. It's not following the traditional model of working on something basically in private, and then only when you are satisfied with it and it's final, do you then put it out into the public, either in closed or, we hope, in open access. To what extent, then, do you see open access as the right way of doing traditional academic or scientific research work? And to what extent do you think that traditional model is being challenged by the wild and open web?
That's a good question. Let me introduce a new term here. Open science is the practice of doing science in the open from the start. If you have a long-running experiment, you post your data as it comes in, and therefore other people, if they care to follow, have access to your data before you've published anything about it.
Your daily notebooks.
Your daily notebooks, lab, for example. Right. And so it's open from beginning to end. It's not just open when you've got something publishable at the end. Open access does not entail open science. Open science entails open access. So open access by itself doesn't create any pressure to follow an open science model. There are reasons to follow an open science model, but if you're not inclined to follow it, or if you're in a field that doesn't have data, like you and me, then you needn't follow it, but you can still make your work open. So in that sense, just to be very narrow, I don't think open access creates special pressure to change the way you do your own research. The way it changes what you, the way it might change your practice is by giving you access to the research of others. And if you can actually read everything that you need to read or everything you want to read to get your own work done, that will change the way you do your work. But it doesn't mean that you'll be sharing more than you are inclined to share.
Or the equivalent in other fields.
That's right.
So there certainly are journalists and novel writers, and in fact, one of the books I wrote, I posted drafts every day. Whatever I had written. It's not a good experiment, by the way, but it is for other people. Nevertheless, so this is a totally speculative question for you, Peter. Do you think that as we get used to a world of open access, as it becomes inevitable and we encounter it more and more, and every time we're glad because it just makes life easier and better for us as researchers or writers or anybody who has an inquiry, do you think that the very success of open access might have an effect on traditional processes by which we work in private, publish in public, that might be affected by our exposure to open access?
Yes. It's hard to spell this out. You were right to make it a speculative question, and I can try to be a little speculative in the answer. There are some fields, again, not our field. David and I are both in philosophy.
Well,
but in, let's say, physics, chemistry, some branches of biology, where knowledge can be organized and where separate discoveries can link together to form a coherent picture where people really have separate...
Which never happens in philosophy.
It never happens in philosophy. That's why I was distinguishing.
Yeah.
So there are fields in which different contributions actually form pieces of a common puzzle, and the different members of the field can recognize that. In those fields, you can actually put the pieces of the puzzle together once they're all out in the open for sharing. This can be done with human intelligence. It can be done by machine eventually. There are lots of ways to do it. There are lots of ways to imagine what the result would look like. Some people are talking about creating a real platform, a single platform to hold this. I don't have any hope that that will work. if you tagged every piece, and intelligently tagged every piece, then you could have intelligent software find the pieces and put them together on the fly for any purpose. I'm not even optimistic about that, because that's too much work for people. They're not going to tag intelligently. But to me, tagging is a makeshift until we have better artificial intelligence. And one day, there'll be machines that can put together these pieces without them all being properly tagged. It won't be a platform. It will be an assemblage. And it can only be done because all the pieces are available. They're all accessible. So to me, just to jump to the back to the topic and to the bottom line, open access is partly important for access to human readers, but it's primarily important for access to machines. If our work is not accessible to our machines, essentially, it's not accessible to us, because we gain access to literature today through our machines. But if our literature is accessible to our machines, then it's accessible to software for all kinds of crunching and processing, some of which we can't even imagine today. So in fields where you could put the pieces of a puzzle together and see the completed puzzle, that will be done. It'll be done perhaps in different ways, in ways that themselves compete for scholarly approval. But it's not the sort of thing that could easily be done, or maybe not done at all, in a world without open access. So my vision of open access is that it will make possible new ways of doing research and putting together the pieces of knowledge. It will make possible new developments which will themselves be very exciting when they come along. And by comparison, open access itself will be unexciting. It will be an historical relic, but it will have been the condition that made all of those other exciting results possible.
An historical relic in the sense that we don't need the word for it anymore because it's the norm.
That's right. It's the norm. We ought to be astounded and grateful at the printing press, and when we work ourselves into it, we can be. But now we take it for granted, and there are all kinds of exciting things that are only possible because of print. Open access will be like that. We will presuppose it, and all of our new and exciting tools for giving us access to knowledge, crunching knowledge, composing knowledge, will presuppose it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Peter Suber is the director of the Harvard Open Access Project and the author of a new guide for those attempting to make sense of open access called simply Open Access. You can find links to more on this topic, including an excerpt from Peter's book, on our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This week's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, and Francis Harlow, with help from Roy Zadolfo, Hilda Barassa, and Amar Asher from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.